Morning. All right. So we come here this morning in Judges chapter 7, and we're in number 4 of a series of, it's the last one in a series of 4 sermons on Judges. And I think, you know, the first thing about the passage is just its familiarity, right? And it sounded like they had a great time in family Sunday school with this, like, tug of war and, like, some people taking it more serious than others. Apparently, Paul, you were told to stop untying the rope round you, round your waist, and all the kids were pulling away. It sounded like a great time. But the thing is, like, with the story, the idea of Gideon, the idea of the army starting at, you know, 32,000 men and then ended up at 300, it's a story for most people who's been to Sunday school they'll be familiar with. And in some ways, the point of the passage itself is quite obvious, you know, even at that kind of Sunday school level, because, you know, God can deliver any victory he wants, you know, even against any kind of human odds, right? He can deliver that victory. And when we come to application, that feels reasonably straightforward as well. You know, that idea that Gideon's army was weak with 300 men, and in the same way we are weak against the opposition of sin, and yet we can overcome sin through God, right? God gives us that victory in sin. It feels in some ways like I won't, but I could go and sit down now, and you know what it was about. I can see faces wishing I would go and sit down, but I genuinely can't. But the truth is that the nuance of the passage is where we start. You know, we're not going to go off what I've just said. You know, what I've just said is what's there, but it's a nuance of the passage that brings it to life for us. Now, if we just, what I'm going to do in kind of two halves, I'm going to start by doing a run through of a passage, which is going to be, is that right, yeah? We're going to start with a run through of a passage, do that for the first half, and then the second half we'll just pull out some implications from it. Now, if you think about where we are, Judges chapter 6, Gideon had got the army together, right? And now, just as we come to chapter 7, the army are marching and they're getting to the point at which they can start to see the Midianites, and the Midianites are encamped. And what we know from Judges chapter 6 is that God is going to deliver a victory for the Israelites. But what we don't know is how he's going to do that. So we look at this. Yeah, and I guess the first thing which becomes apparent in terms of that how is in verses 3 to 8. And what God starts to do is he starts to reduce the army. So he reduces the army down from 32,000 men to 300 men. And the question is why? Well, God gives us the answer why in verse 2. It says this, "The Lord said to Gideon, 'The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me.'" So God reveals his purpose here in verse 2. You know, God's very capable of saving the people from the Midianites however he wants. He could have saved them with 32,000 men, or he could have saved them with 300 men. But what he wants to be really clear and really obvious and really unambiguous about is that it is he who saved them, not them. Now, one of the rules of preaching is you're not meant to use sports analogies. We've got to break that rule amongst many others. In 2015, Leicester City were given odds of 5,000 to 1 of winning the Premier League, right? And the reason for that is that the previous season, they just escaped relegation. So they were meant to be in a league basically below rather than that league. And no one in the history of the Premier League had ever one season been right at the bottom, and then the next season got even anywhere near close to the top. Hence the odds were 5,000 to 1. And yet, one of the largest upsets, probably in the history of football, happened when Leicester City that year won the Premier League by 10 points. And there's these great stories you were reading in the newspaper. There were Leicester City fans who placed £10 bets on them winning the league and then ended up clearing off their mortgage. There was another slightly more tragic story of this guy who every previous year had placed a bet on Leicester winning. And then this one year decided, oh, you know what, they've got no chance. But the thing about Leicester winning the league is, right, whilst it's unbelievable and it was very unlikely, it wasn't a miracle. A miracle would have been if a manager had said, actually, do you know what? Rather than play with 11 men, we're going to send 9 in, you're going to play with 2 men every week, and you're going to win the league with 2 men against 11. That would have been a miracle. And for the Israelites in Judges chapter 7, God doesn't want them to kind of get into the Leicester City mindset. He doesn't want to think these 32,000 men don't really stand much of a chance, but maybe 1 in 100 years they might be able to win this victory against the Midianites, you know, with the right strategy. So he reduces the army down to 300. Now, there's an interesting bit in verse 12 where we find out why it is that these 32,000 men to begin with aren't enough. It says this: the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. So, I mean, if you know, that's a literary device, right? The idea is the Midianites cannot be counted, but I'm going to put a specific number on the Israelites of 32,000 to say they're small enough that they can be counted. This is the kind of thing you guys should be doing in your exams. It's like free tips. No one looks very convinced. It's obviously not a very good insight. No one looks remotely convinced. But in verse 9, right, so God's taken this point of reducing the army. He reduces it down to 300, right? And he does it in 2 different ways. First, he sends home anyone who's fearful, and second, he's got this test for how they drink the water. And I don't think there's any huge significance in either of those 2 things. They're just a way of getting the numbers right down. But in verse 9, having got the numbers right down, God switches approach. He's reduced Gideon's army to this tiny remnant where he's not got anything like the right number of people. And then what he does is he wants to give Gideon assurance. He wants to give Gideon encouragement. And he says to Gideon, he says, go down to the Midian camp. And as you go down, you're going to hear something which encourages you. And as Gideon walks into the camp, we've got to bear in mind that this camp is absolutely huge. The only thing we know for sure is it's a lot more than 32,000 people because it can't be counted. Gideon just happens to walk past the tent, and he hears what we see in verse 13. It says this: when Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade, and he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. And his comrade answered, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp. Now, that dream's odd, right? It's odd on a number of different levels. The first one is the idea that a loaf of bread rolling down a hill would somehow knock over a tent, because clearly it wouldn't. And this is pointing to the miraculous nature of God's rescue, right? Gideon would be like this loaf of bread, which one, didn't have the power to knock over the tent, but secondly, didn't really have any control over what was going on. And the second thing is that the second man identifies Gideon as a loaf of bread. He identifies Gideon as a person who's got to deliver the victory. Now, he had no way of doing that. Gideon wasn't a military leader at that point. He would have had no way of knowing that. And he also states, thirdly, that God had given Midian into Gideon's hands. And for Gideon overhearing this conversation, having been directed by God, is a great spiritual experience for him. He's at this point of total weakness, of having had everything which he relies upon stripped away. So he's got these 300 men. And it's at that point of utter weakness that God chooses to reveal himself to him. And Gideon, in verse 15, his response is to worship God. And then at that point, Gideon organizes the army, and he basically takes the 300 and he splits it into 3 camps, so 100, 100, 100. And the odd thing, which actually passed me by on first reading, but what actually happens is in one hand they've got a trumpet, and in the other hand they've got a jar. And the idea is that they go down into the camp, they blow the trumpet, and they smash the jar. Now, what's actually terrifying about that, if you're one of the 300 men, is you've not got a hand for your sword, right? You're literally walking down into a camp, there's 300 of you, against countless number, and you literally have you cannot defend yourself. So they do as God has commanded. They blow the trumpets, they smash the glasses. And it's interesting, just a little details in the passage. We look at verse 21. Every man stood in his place around the camp. You know, they just literally stand there. They don't even run. They literally, they do what God has commanded and they literally just stay there. And the reason, you know, there's various theories, and I can talk to you afterwards about kind of how it happened, why it happened, military strategy, etc. But the point is super, super clear of why it happened. It's in verse 22. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. And the army fled. God did it right. You know, God overrules in this situation. He sets the army against each other and they flee. And the Israelites are called out from all the different places and they chase them and they kill down as many as they can. And that's the story of Gideon. And it's worth saying, if you've not been here before, for any of the rest of the series, that the Midianites have been oppressing the Israelites, right? They've been putting them under terrible suffering. And that's the reason for this military victory, right? They'd been putting them basically under slavery, but they'd been taking their food, they'd been taking their livelihood, and the Israelites had cried out in the previous chapter and said, God help us. And that's why God delivers this victory for them. So what does it mean? Well, we know what it means in verse 2, right? You know, where it says, the Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. God doesn't want the Israelites to boast about their salvation. He wants them to see that it's all him. And Judges 7 is all about weakness. It's about Gideon having only 300 men to overturn this countless army. You know, and these 300 men have got nothing in their hands other than a trumpet and a jar. And we know, and we're familiar with the idea that we can contribute nothing to our salvation, nothing to being saved, right? That's something which we know. And we're used to the idea of God working in spite of our weakness. But what is going on here is more than God working in spite of weakness. This is God deliberately making them weak and working through that. You know, God isn't just working against long odds. He's making the odds longer. He's not just working in weakness, he's adding to the weakness. Now, we've got to be really careful here of how we apply that, because the passage isn't talking directly into any of my circumstances or into any of your circumstances. And I think, you know, the temptation is to say something like, you know, look at the difficulties in your life and trust God that he's using them to make you weak and make you trust him. You know, that idea that you've got stuff going on, actually, that God has somehow given you that to make you trust in him. Now, that may be true, that may not be true, but the point is that we cannot, I don't know, and we don't know why God does what he does. And the passage doesn't say that. But we can say this, that if this morning you feel weak, for whatever that reason that is, then be comforted. Be encouraged, because what we do know is that God uses the weakness that is in our lives to encourage us, to drive us closer to him, to give us a deeper spiritual experience of himself. You know, it was for Gideon, it's just really marked, isn't it? It was the point that he had 300 men. It was the point that he had every security around him torn away. It was the point that he was weakest. That was the point at which God gave him blessing. That was the point at which he worshipped God. And I think, you know, I feel weak, and hopefully we all feel weak in different ways, but I think the answer for that weakness of what we do with it isn't so much that we do worry about it, or even that we pray to God to take away that weakness. I think what this passage is telling us that we need to learn is that we ask, rather than say to God, take away my weakness, we say to God, reveal yourself to me in the weakness that I have. Use the weakness I have to draw me closer to you. And it may be that it's only as we see our weakness that we have real joy in understanding God's strength. And that was certainly the case for the Apostle Paul. I don't know if everyone's got a page number for 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I'm nearly 970. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul is talking about his weakness, right? You see, and he's got a specific weakness. He refers to it as a thorn in the flesh. He doesn't mention what it is, but he says this about it. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord about this. He's talking about his weakness, that it should leave me. But God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. This is Paul speaking again. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, I am strong. You know, from a world point of view, the gospel is weak, right? You know, the gospel looks like 300 men going into battle without any weapons. You know, in the world's eyes, us meeting this morning and talking about a man who died 2,000 years ago for us on a cross and saying we trust him and we worship him, that is mad. It seems crazy. And yet, to trust Jesus is to have eternal life. And that is a faith which Judges is talking about. It's talking about not looking at the 300 men, not looking at the circumstances which are in our lives, but looking instead at the unseen future promises of God and saying, I trust those and I have faith in those, and I choose those over looking at the weakness of my circumstances. And Gideon in chapter 11 of Hebrews is commended for that. He's commended for a faith which pins its hopes on the promises of God rather than concerning himself with a tiny army that he was commanded. And you know, the things around us, they feel very real, don't they? You know, our families, our friends, our places of work, even our church, it feels real, it feels tangible. It feels like these are things that can be grasped, they can be understood, they can be felt. But the promises of God aren't like that. They can't be seen or felt or touched. They're not tangible things. And that makes them hard to trust in. It can make them seem foolish. It leads us, you know, we're leading lives which don't make sense to the people around us. I remember years ago having a drink with some work colleagues and their partners, and we sat on this table. And I was trying to explain to them the gospel. And I was trying to say, look, the gospel really makes sense. And I was trying to come up with reasons. I was trying to rationalize it. I was trying to say, look, you can reason yourself all your way to Jesus here. This makes perfect sense. There's not a hole in this argument. Trusting the gospel is the intelligent thing to do. But the gospel isn't like that, is it? Of course, it does make sense. But it's not designed to appeal to the wise. It's not designed to be reasoned to in that way. You know, one of the preeminent scientists of our time, Stephen Hawking, wrote a book, A Brief History of Time, and his whole book was devoted to, you know, where does the world come from and how could this world be here without God? And he may have, you know, people estimated an IQ of 170, right? I think we all agreed he wasn't stupid. But he's now dead. He's now dead without hope. And you know, what a contrast to a number of years ago, I went to a place called the Lodge Trust, which some of you will have heard of, and that place is for adults with learning difficulties. And I mean no disrespect like this, but those guys, you know, there'll be adults there who could probably be outreasoned by a 7-year-old child intellectually. And yet, as I was walking around, after the manager said to me, it stuck with me, she said, these guys have an incredible faith in Jesus. They pray simple prayers, and they trust that these prayers will happen. And they are not surprised when these prayers are answered. They love Jesus, and he loves them, and they know that. And they were right, and I was wrong. In my arrogance, I was wrong. I wanted the gospel to be something that could be reasoned, that we could, you know, we could intellectually work our way to. Something which... And yet, it is in utter weakness that Jesus came to save us. And it's in utter weakness which we respond to it. And you know, this morning, and I am closing up now, but you know, maybe you're unable to serve in church in the way you like. Maybe your life hasn't got the strength in it you'd like. Maybe you're unable to have a job that you feel would really help serve Jesus. Maybe, like me, the issues you have are more in your head. Well, the gospel is for weak people like me and weak people like you. God doesn't ask us to fix our weakness. He doesn't ask us to fix our mental state. He doesn't ask us to fix our physical weaknesses. Instead, he asks us to trust him as we are, with our weaknesses. He asks us to be prepared to look foolish, to look stupid, like those 300 men without a weapon, and to trust him that he will rescue us anyway. His promises may not be visible, but they are real. The promise of Jesus rescuing us and taking us to heaven for an eternal paradise with him is more real than anything we can feel, we can touch, we can reason. The heart of faith is trusting that. And Hebrews 11, verse 32 says this. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of a sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Well, I guess I close this mini-series where I started it in Hebrews chapter 11, looking at faith. You know, for Barak, Deborah and Gideon, the odds were against them. And in human terms, they had no chance of succeeding. And yet, they had one important thing, and that was faith in God's unseen promises. And this morning, we should all be celebrating in our weakness, because our weakness doesn't matter. What matters is that God is strong, and our weakness should be driving us to God. It should be driving us to have trust and faith in the unseen promises of God. Let me pray to close. Dear Father, it is not easy. It's not easy to be weak, and it's not easy for us to recognize that we're weak. And equally, I for one find it difficult to trust in unseen promises and to be prepared to look foolish, to be prepared to be like those 300 men with a jar and a trumpet, when all I want to do is get a big army and a load of swords. And yet we know that the way you save us isn't like that. The way you save us is through weakness. Lord, please, please help me, please help all of us to not try and escape our weakness, but to use it to drive us closer to you, to know you more, to love you more, and to pin a stronger hope on those future promises, Lord. Amen.